it's Tracy Tully, and you're listening to Tracy Tully Talks at bbsradio.com, the place to be right now, streaming live with another 60 minutes of thought-provoking topics, sharing with you conversations that are relevant today, tomorrow, and in the future. Join me each week on Thursday mornings at 10 a.m. Australian time, AEST, 5 p.m. Wednesday PT, hello Los Angeles. If you missed the live show, jump onto your favorite podcasting platform and you'll find me on Tracy Tully Talks. We do have some adult language, so if you have some little ones around, pop on your earphones. Hello and welcome. It's Tracy here from Tracy Tully Talks, bbsradio.com. And it's lovely to listen to you today and to be able to present our guest, Michelle Dewsbury. And Michelle is US-based. She's an author, a humanitarian, and she's also an actress. She'll be coming on shortly, so let me tell you a little bit about Michelle. She's the founder of a non-profit group called Unsilenced Voices, and Michelle travels all over the world and helps people in abusive relationships. Did you know that in the US alone, one in four women are in abusive relationships, and one in seven men are in abusive relationships? So that data is quite a worry. Michelle is a master instructor, and she can help you work out right at the beginning of a relationship if there's anything there that you're worried about that you feel might not work for you, could have the possible danger of being in an abusive relationship. Michelle also helps you shift your attitude, identify and overcome obstacles, shift alternative perspectives, and control your emotions. So we're going to speak to Michelle very, very shortly as she comes on board. And I'd like to introduce you now. There we go. Hello, Michelle. How are you?
Hello, Tracy. I'm doing well. How are you?
I'm very, very well. Thank you. And it's great to see you on board here. Last we met, our listeners, was in Egypt in March. So it's great to see and hear Michelle today. Michelle, I've just been telling our listeners that you are the founder of the group Unsilenced Voices, and that you're a humanitarian, an actress, a global speaker, and an author. I wonder if you could tell us about what you do with that nonprofit group, Unsilenced Voices.
Yeah, definitely, Tracy. And thank you so much for having me on. I look forward to sharing with your audience and being able to help and assist people who need it. I'll kind of go through my story a little bit, if that's okay, Tracy.
Absolutely.
Perfect. So I'm going to fast forward my life until, I don't know, let's say 16 years old. And then my mom works in the restaurant industry, and she trains me to be a restauranteur. So I work as a server, a hostess, and back of the house, bartending, managing. But I knew that I wanted something more. So like a lot of people out there, I decided to take a plunge. I fell in love with acting, and I wanted to move to Hollywood, California. So I packed up my car and drove my happy little butt when I was 19 years old to Hollywood, California to pursue an acting career. And I loved it. I loved being on stage. I loved interacting with people, very similar to the restaurant industry, being able to talk with one another. Fast forward a few years, and things are going well, producing plays, starring in things. And I end up meeting this man, blonde haired, blue eyes, swept me off my feet, right? Really handsome, really was going someplace in life. He courted me. He sent me flowers and text messages. We went to ball games. And about 4 months into that relationship, my head went through the drywall. And at that time, I didn't even understand that that was the beginning stages of a domestic violence relationship. It took me 4 years of being with Paul that it finally dawned on me that I was being severely abused. And I remember escaping that relationship and sitting in front of my computer, like I'm doing now in front of Zoom. And I started documenting things that happened to me. And when I documented them, I had an aha moment, like, wow, I can't believe that this is me. And again, I had that feeling of, I need to do more. So when I started documenting, I ended up writing a solo play, a 65-minute solo play about my experience with domestic violence. And that consisted of me playing roughly 13 to 15 different characters. I beat myself up on stage a lot. I endured physical, sexual, emotional, and financial abuse from Paul. But what happened next was actually pretty incredible. People started coming up to me and thanking me for sharing my story and for speaking up for those people who couldn't speak for themselves. And then I was like, okay, well, maybe I can turn this into something. And in July of 2017, I founded Unsilenced Voices. Oh, that way. It's a 501c3 nonprofit here in the United States. We're based in the US, but however, we work primarily in Ghana, Sierra Leone, and now we expanded to Rwanda. We are expanding to the United States as soon as COVID lifts, but I love being able to impact so many people through the organization. And we do programming, educational programming. We help young girls off the streets who are selling themselves as sex workers. We're giving hope to hopeless. And it's not only humbling work, but it's necessary work. And then I published my book not too long ago, which is great. And I'm sure we'll get into that. And then now I'm a speaker and travel everywhere. So that's where we met, Tracy. So happy that we met in Egypt in March.
It was a wonderful time. And it was absolutely fascinating to hear what you do. And you're going to some pretty, pretty difficult countries, some very challenging countries. And I know when I was listening to you then, and listening to you now, what is going through my head is when you go into a country like Ghana or Rwanda or Sierra Leone, how do you help the women protect themselves after you've done the training and you leave? How do you help them move on from that point? Because I would assume that abusers would not like the fact that you're there.
Of course not. But however, we don't just educate women. When I was in Sierra Leone the first time, the women, when we were doing a sensitization, asked me, can we please include the men? And I said, okay, if that's what you want, let's include the men. So that's what we started doing. We started incorporating the men and the women, and we integrate them. So usually they sit on opposite sides, but we're like, no, sit together. We're going to have an open forum type of conversation. And when we did that, a lot of the men didn't understand that it wasn't okay to beat your wife. And unfortunately, there are a lot of cultural differences, and a lot of women have come up to me and said, oh, I didn't know that this wasn't right. So it's just education and educating the community about morals and values, and that women are just as superior, just as worthy, just as wonderful as men are. And that's how we kind of started helping. And then we also work with the police in both Ghana and Sierra Leone. So we work with DoveSu, which is the Domestic Violence and Victim Support Unit in Ghana. And we also work with the Family Support Unit in Sierra Leone. So we help those women if they choose to press charges against their abuser, because it is illegal in that country, and provide some of those resources, including initial medical examinations and, just support in general. So, it's a hard thing being different culturally, but it's working out well. And I'm sure it is pissing off some abusers, but so what, right?
Well, it's all about change, isn't it? As you know. Now, tell me, Michelle, how do you fund this all this? Because there's a lot of money I can hear that would be required to fly, train. No doubt you're providing all sorts of tools while you're there. So how do you generate an income for that?
Yeah, so here in the United States, since we are a 501c3, we can fundraise. So we've had a multiple fundraising events, and I've actually put in roughly $40,000 of my own money to make Unsilenced Voices grow. And I know that that's not sustainable, but it got us to where we are now. And now we are incorporating grants, and we have some interns on board who are locating those grants for us. And we are partnering with other organizations. And 10% of everything I make goes back to Unsilenced Voices. So that's why I do a lot of speaking and coaching. I'm a private coach as well, and help people to overcome a lot of challenges. And 10% at least goes back into the organization. And the Small Business Association, we were able to get a small loan, which is great, and also a small grant during COVID. So that's kind of how we've been able to sustain ourselves for now. And then we definitely are seeking funds. We need help. Every nonprofit organization needs help. So if your listeners are out there and this resonates with you, you can always visit unsilencedvoices.org to donate. And we would so much appreciate that.
Sounds wonderful, and it's very meaningful. And I suppose it resonates really well because you're building. So you're building into these challenging countries, and it's growing. Now, once you ship out and leave and you've done your training, what sort of structure do you put in place that stays and keeps that momentum going?
So we have managers that are in Sierra Leone. We've got managers and supervisors, but we partner with organizations that are ran by local residents, ran by locals. So in Ghana, we have partnered with an organization called the ARC Foundation, and we help to subsidize their training, their shelter. We do a lot of training together in schools about domestic violence and abuse, and we find it oftentimes that teachers are the ones who are abusing these students. So then we educate the students and also educate the teachers. Same thing in Sierra Leone. We've partnered with different organizations, but in Sierra Leone, we actually have staff. So we have two managers and then we've got a couple other gals who volunteer their time who are now slowly getting paid, which is great. And because of that, we're able to maintain a structure. And then we've partnered with a woman named Comfort who runs the Bow Women's Vocational Training Center. And that's where we actually enroll our girls into the vocational school in order for them to learn a skill, whether it be tie-dye and gara or hairdressing or baking, whatever they choose, but they learn that skill instead of selling their bodies, like I said. So it's always partnering with local organizations. And I think that that's so incredibly important because it's not me as a Westerner trying to bring everything to Africa. It's partnering with Africans and addressing their concerns and their needs.
It's really important, isn't it? So your platform is brilliant because it's the train the trainer. And you're setting it up for consistency and continuity, longevity. This is really important because here in Australia, we have a funding grants. And my history is, as you would know, is a principal for 38 years. And you can imagine how much daily abuse I saw. And what we have is grants here. But the grants that we have, they when they run out, there's nothing else. Everything stops. And this is the same cycle year in, year out. And it's really, really frustrating when you get something going and then all of a sudden the government will go for something else, another, you know, pie in the sky grant with ridiculous criteria. But what you have done, founding Unsilenced Voices, is really special because you could step away and someone else could come in and run it. So
that
if you're
what... Yeah, that is what our hope is for sure. Yeah. So that's what my hope is that not only in West Africa and Rwanda, but also around the globe, we want to start a movement. Unsilenced Voices is not just a nonprofit, but it's a movement to encourage victims and survivors to speak up. And once they speak up, then we see this domino effect of change. We have one gal who's she's amazing. So we found her on the streets and we enrolled her in the training center. And now she has learned a skill, but she's also helping Unsilenced Voices with advocacy. So when we go out to the streets and do community and village sensitizations, when we are now, because of COVID, giving microloans and rice and water and clean food to some of these individuals, she's there. She's right there. And it's so wonderful because in March when I was there, I got to meet her. And I was very emotional with that because, you know, she literally took the shirt off of her back. She made me clothes. She gave me a chicken, which is so significant because a chicken can feed her whole family, you know? And, she was very appreciative, but I am so appreciative of what she is doing. And that's what we want to create, these survivors and these victims who are now not victims, they're victors. And then now they can make a difference in their own country. And then it's that domino effect of change, and it's sustainable change.
And what's also fantastic is that they're great role models. So you've got all the children coming on seeing this, so you've literally got a movement of change happening. This is really great, and it's great that the police support you in those areas and the government supports you.
It took a few times of me visiting the countries and shaking the right people's hands in order for us to have that collaborative effort together. We are helping the FSU in Sierra Leone a little bit with like stationery and things like that, because unfortunately corruption starts at the top in most of the African nations. And then because of that, the people who actually really want to make change, the police officers, they don't get the funding that they need. So they're using their own money to drive, to go see these victims, to document things on their computer, using their own pens, stationery, everything. So it's not funded. And that's the reason why people think that Africa is so corrupt, but it starts at the top. So what we really need to do is stop that corruption from here so we can create that change down here that is so necessary.
Mm. And I can imagine there would have been some quite challenging, frightening times in this program's progress. Can you share something with us so that we can have an understanding of what challenges you might have had to come across?
Well, specifically really in Sierra Leone, I have to fly into Freetown in order to get there. And then we take a 4-hour drive getting to Bo. And we can't drive at night. It's not safe, especially for you know, a Caucasian blonde haired woman. So we make sure to drive during the day. And I really haven't been approached by anybody that I feel threatened by. However, I know the danger is out there. So there was a time that I was volunteering for nonprofits before I started my own. And I traveled to Kenya with a great organization who works out of Portland, Oregon, and it's called Kizimani. And when I traveled to Kenya, it was really my first experience in an African nation. And we were there for medical and to help primarily the children there. But we had to drive past a lot of gates and a lot of police stops. And multiple times, because we were a van of Caucasians primarily, they typically thought that we always had money. So we would always get, you know, please give us money, give us money. And it was the police officers. It's like, well, if you want to pass, you got to pay us. The great thing over there is that because we were medical and we had medical doctors and everything, they actually let us go through. But there were times, you know, because over there, you know, they're fully loaded with guns. And it was kind of scary being my first time in an African country experiencing that. So, you know, now we're just kind of getting used to it. I tend to cover my hair a lot, and it's not necessary, but I do just for safety and precautions. But yeah, that's kind of the dangers over there. But you know, when you're called to do something, you don't let the danger stop you.
No, and that's the important part, isn't it? And the word fear is linked to that, obviously. And if you had the fear, this never would have happened. But through your fear and your story, you have come to this point. It's quite fascinating. If one of our listeners were really keen to go with you on a trip, is that possible?
So I'm planning on putting together a trip. I was going to do it for 2021, but because of COVID, it might be pushed to 2022. Mm-hmm. When I was vice president for Young Vision Africa, we put together a group of people to come with us. And that was in Sierra Leone. So I feel very safe taking a group of people to Sierra Leone because the place we stay, it's ran by Helping Children Worldwide, HCW, and it's protected. There's a guard there that is armed, and we're protected. We have meals. You know, we've got a cold shower, but we've got a place, clean water. So yes, I am hoping to put together a group in 2021 or 2022, probably in April-ish, to go to Sierra Leone.
That's fabulous. That's really good. So if anyone is out there listening today and they're keen on a volunteer style adventure, it would be really, wouldn't it? Mm-hmm. To contact you through your website. Now, I know that you've got your new book, Because I Love Him, But I Love Him. And Michelle, for our listeners, she teaches how to protect yourself from domestic abuse in your relationship. I wonder if you can talk to us about your book. And I heard before when we introduced you that you were writing things down, so you were reflecting on what was happening, and then you must have had your big aha moment. So tell us a little bit about your book.
Yeah, of course. Thank you again, Tracy. So it was interesting when I started documenting because I didn't think that I would write a book. I didn't even think I was going to write a play. So when it came out in play format and I actually performed it on stage, I then knew that I wanted to transform the script into a book. And I actually sued my abuser. So I didn't publish right away. I actually only published last year. And this is my book, if you guys get here. But it is, it's a little different than my play. So my play, because of theatrical needs, it's probably only about 70 to 80% true. My book is 100% true. And in the book, I actually talk a lot about resources. I talk a lot about statistics. I did a lot of research in order to write my book, but it is my full story. And I, you know, I disguise names and sometimes places, but it is accurate. It's a 100% accurate description and depiction of what I went through. And I do talk about a lot of red flags because oftentimes you get yourself involved in an abusive relationship and you don't see the flags because you are blinded by love. You're blinded by what it is that you want to see in the future. And for me, it was, you know, my Prince Charming. And I so badly wanted Paul to be that Prince Charming. And he wasn't. So writing the book, it was hard. I cried a lot. I drank a lot of wine. I remember doing that oftentimes. but it does give you a lot of resources and a look into an abusive relationship and why people stay.
And that's going to be my next question. I suppose my question would be, how does someone so lovely like yourself get trapped in this type of relationship?
Yeah, it's a question that I hear all the time, and that's why I wrote the play and the book. But there's a cycle in domestic violence, and the cycle goes from walking on eggshells to a big blow up, and then the apology stage. And that apology stage keeps most victims trapped in an abusive relationship. So let me give you an example, if that's okay. I'm gonna talk about an incident that happened between Paul and I, where it was October of 2012. And, you know, we were at a Halloween party, you know, dressed up, dancing, and Paul deliriously thought that I was flirting with somebody else. So in his drunken state, he literally grabbed my arm and said, "We have to go." He dropped his drink in the middle of the floor, shattering everywhere. And at that point I was like, oh, you know, he's really upset. I'm not gonna, you know, trigger him anymore. So I drudgingly followed him to the car and sat in the passenger seat and allowed him to drive in and out and swerve in and out of traffic to go home. And as soon as we got home, he pulled me out of the car by my hair and threw me inside the house. And then the onslaught began. And there was a lot of physical violence that night. I tried to escape multiple times. It was roughly about 4 hours of abuse that happened. And I remember when he finally started coming to, because I think he was in a drunken state, not understanding what he was doing or really why he was doing it. And when he finally came to, he noticed, you know, blood covering my face and all over my body and bruises. I had bruises everywhere. I was thrown into walls and thrown into shoe racks and you name it. And he had pushed so severely on my face while I was on the bed that my entire eye was black. You couldn't see any white in my eyes. So he took me in the shower and rinsed the blood off of me. And at that point, I was too weak to even lift my hands to wash my hair. And then he laid me in bed next to him and he held my hand. And I think he held my hand for fear that I was going to leave. But I was just too distraught, too tired to even think about running anymore. And I drifted in and out of consciousness that night. And when I woke up the next day, Paul was staring right at me. And then he began to sob and began to cry, like hysterically cry. And he said, "I am so sorry, Michelle. I love you so much. Please forgive me. I promise I will never, ever do this again." And I believed him. And at that point, he believed it as well. So that is the apology stage in an abusive relationship. I looked awful. People thought I had jaundice in my eye because it stayed yellow for almost 9 months. The bruises, the bloodshot eye, like it was pretty bad. And it stayed like that for a month, if not longer. And like I said, my eye was yellow for about nine. But he promised he wouldn't do it. He really did promise he wouldn't do it again. And unfortunately, that's why so many people get trapped and so many people stay, because you really want to believe them. But if the abuser doesn't get the help that they desperately need, then the cycle will continue. And that's why people stay.
So the next situation that followed that was your first one? Was
The October event, that was the most severe one. There was some physical violence here and there prior to that, strangulation, slapping, throwing into walls. Like I said, 4 months into the relationship, he had pushed me so hard that my head went through. However, it didn't stop, right? So there were multiple other ones after that as well, but that was the most severe.
So what happens in a person's mind, what is it that makes them stay besides the fact that they love that person? What else? There'd be lots of other things going on that would be the fear.
There definitely are many other things, underlying things, worthiness, thinking that he or she, your abuser, believing the lies. You know, the gaslighting happens a lot. And what gaslighting is that your abuser or the narcissist really makes you believe something different than how it actually happened. So he dumbs down the situation. Oh, it's not that bad. I remember after that October beating, us going to a restaurant, and I was wearing sunglasses and I ordered a glass of wine. So of course the waitress wanted to check my ID to make sure I was old enough to drink. And I took off my glasses and she's like, right. And afterwards, you know, I put them back on slowly and Paul's like, it's not that bad. And just dumbing down the situation. So especially me, in that abusive relationship, I believed him when things weren't that bad, right? And a lot of people do. And then there's, you know, financial consequences of leaving an abusive relationship. There's children, there could be children involved. And that's very, very difficult. Some people stay because of the kids, and that's not the best thing to do. Oftentimes people do couples therapy as well, which couples therapy, according to some of the statistics, is actually very bad. You really need separate therapy. You believe that you are the only friend of your abuser and that your abuser greatly relies on you. So subconsciously you feel like, I need to stay because I can help him. I can help him heal. I can help him get over a lot of his fears and obstacles. And then of course there's that fear aspect. There was one time where I got home and I knew after a therapy appointment, she was like, "You got to get out." And I knew I had to start packing my car, but I was so scared. I literally sat on the little sofa in our living room at the time, and Paul was at work. And I just remember like shaking so bad. And I was like, calm yourself down, Michelle. And I took a shower, and Paul still had a couple more hours. And I'm like, you got to do this. So I literally just took everything, clothes on the hangers, and just started throwing everything I had in my car. And I left, and Paul had a tracking thing on my phone at that time. Mm. So when I left, he had told me later on that he had followed me partially all the way to LA. I'm glad he didn't get to me, but yeah, it was scary. Very, very, very scary. There was also a time after I had escaped where I moved into an apartment building, and this apartment building, I didn't want my name on any of the utilities. So I didn't want anybody to know that it was public knowledge, right, where I was living. But I was working as a bartender during that time, and I would come home very, very late, and I had to take an elevator two floors up. And I remember every time those doors opened, I used to think that Paul or somebody that he hired was going to be on the other end of that elevator, the other side, and he was going to kill me. So yes, fear. There's a lot of fear, but I knew I had to leave. I knew I had to continue speaking up. I knew I had to get out. I felt God with me the whole time, which was amazing. And it's really hard for some people sometimes because of that fear, because it's like, if I don't trigger him, then he won't blow up as bad. And that's kind of where a lot of people think. And that's where we gotta stop this. It's a horrible, horrible cycle.
My word it is. And as I mentioned before, I found in my 38-year career in education, where I see students who are abused, parents who come and talk to me about the abuse, staff who are abused, and it goes on and on and on. And as you said, the cycle is very real, and actually it is quite transparent, the cycle. Some of the communities I was living in and working in, they accepted it. So everyone was desensitized to it, really desensitized. So it became a problem. I remember one school, the very first day I started in this school, and my brief was to clean it up. The very first day I started, I drove in, and there's a male student standing over, had a female student on the ground, on the oval, standing or kneeling over her with a cigarette, a lit cigarette, burning her. And I dealt with it immediately, but I went into the office and I said, how could this possibly happen? How could you possibly allow that to happen? The basic knowledge of people being out there before school starts on the oval doing yard duty and protecting students from other students. What sort of attitude was in that school in terms of the leadership before I went there? Mm-hmm. So if the leaders aren't modelling it, and there's the admin office not far, not many metres away, and that's happening on an oval, it's very desensitised. So people accept it, and they don't want to know about it. They brush it under the rug.
Yeah, and sometimes they think that it's just a family issue, that it's, you know, the woman did something. She it's her fault and her responsibility. So then the family says she's got to fix it. And and then she ends up staying. And it is, it's a cultural norm, right? And we have become desensitized all over the world, not in West Africa only, not in the US or not in Australia only. It's everywhere. I remember traveling to India and the severity of how men treat women in India just blew my mind. And we have been so desensitized since the beginning of time about injustices, racial discrimination, gender discrimination, that people don't really stand up for others. Like you said, when you went to that school and you saw the kid, the male standing over the female and burning her, other people must have known that was going on. Right. Yeah, and they just let it continue. And we have to start to stand up. There's not very many people in this world who actually take a stand for something. It doesn't have to be against abuse. It could be, against climate change, or it could be against plastics in the ocean. But people have to take a stand for something, because that's the only way we are going to create sustainable change. and stop these horrible cycles. You know, human trafficking is one of them as well. And, you know, kids are taken. There's 200,000 kids in the U.S. that are being trafficked. According to the Child Liberation Foundation's website, there are 18 million children worldwide that are being trafficked. That means that there are thousands, hundreds of thousands of people that know about this. And the thing is, we have to stop the supply and demand. So it's the demand that we really have to put our foot down and be like, this is not okay. And this is why it's so important to get men on board as well, to say, hey, bro, stop doing that. It's not okay to treat a woman like that. You know, they're equal just like we are. So yeah, I'm sorry to go off on this tangent, Tracy, but it drives me crazy. There are so many things that we could be doing, and a lot of people aren't doing them.
No, I agree with you. And don't ever apologize for doing or saying things that support something like abuse, because it's something that's close to my heart. And I can honestly say, in all of the schools I worked in 38 years, that was probably the biggest thing I had to deal with, abuse and drugs. And too often they were related. Mm-hmm. But the abuse never ceased to amaze me. And I found my own organization didn't want to know about it. In fact, they would turn a blind eye. And I was told that I had to leave the kids in the school and they wouldn't give us any support, nothing at all to help us. And these schools were poor. These communities were poor. So you really had no way of changing the system unless you came up with something out of the box. And one of the things that I came out with at that stage, this is a rural area and sheep and wool were big in that area. And so I actually was the first in the world to start a shearer training program for students. And it was particularly for these, and they were built like men, these kids. They were literally very strong, very big, and adults, and had lived like that, and very abusive. I was very fortunate to get a company called Sunbeam. You would know maybe about Sunbeam Appliances, who backed us, who actually gave us a free trainer, equipment, and then we had the Australian Workers Union came in behind us and helped us. We had this remarkable change all of a sudden. And it showed me that it could be done. It took an enormous amount of work, but my own department didn't want to know anything about it. Were really angry with me for doing it because it wasn't, you know, what school was about. And of course it was what school was about, because we were doing something actively. We were taking the kids off the street, and the male role models in with this particular group was our first group. This is going back to 2004. And they were tough. They were really, really tough. And there's nothing I haven't seen. And they had the male role models in the shearing sheds. So they were taken out of their environment. And what we found was, and you touched on this before, is that sense of identity. They had been abused themselves for so long. They had no sense of identity and self-awareness. And this is one of the big problems, isn't it, the issues?
Yeah, you lose yourself for sure. And you lose yourself in relationships. You lose yourself just thinking of survival every day. Sometimes I remember going to my therapist and just being like, I'm so tired all the time. And I wasn't even working. And she, it was a female at that point. Now I have a male therapist, but she's like, well, it makes complete sense because you're living in fear every single day. And that's emotionally draining. So because you're living in fear, you can't do positive things for yourself. You can't read great books. You can't break free from the abusive relationships and the environment. So being able to put in that positive material, but yeah, you know, it is a, it's a tough situation, you know, it really, really is, but you got to break free from it.
And there's no excuse for it. That's the bottom line. Here in Australia, it just never ceased to shock me. Really shocked me and saddened me that no one wanted to know about it. Mm-hmm. And it really needs to be in schools right down at the very, very beginning in preschool. It really needs to be targeted there. So unlocking their voices, you know, the title of your company there, your group, is Unsilenced Voices. So taking that muzzle off and allowing them to speak up. I think I had so much success in my schools because I would stand on the stage every single week, and I would say, never be scared of coming to me. Never, ever be scared of coming to me. And if you're really scared, get a mate to come to me, because I'll make sure it stops. I will. And I love the fact that they did. They did do that. And their stories were horrific, absolutely horrific. You know, the rapes, and you having kids talking to you about every minute of their rape by a stepfather or a family member or a family friend. And it was sickening, absolutely sickening. And we can't stand by it. Now, tell me, with your book, do you have any tips there that you can share with our listeners in terms of what to look out for? What are some of those little warning signs that people really need to know about? And because, you know, we're hearing this story, and you and I have heard this a lot, but there's a lot of people that wouldn't, that are probably in the position that you are in, and they need to hear right now the cold hard facts of what are those early warning signs.
Yeah, there are definitely early warning signs, and I actually blatantly ignored a lot of them in my relationship. But moving the relationship too quickly is a key one as well. When the narcissist or abuser, let's move in together, let's go from 0 to 100 in the relationship so fast. And then the isolation aspect, of course, he or she will try to isolate you, have them move far away from your community. I remember I moved far, like 3.5 hours from my community, and I ended up losing a lot of friends during that time as well. The way that he or she speaks to people in the restaurant, especially their servers, you know, if they're condescending, if they're just rude and mean, that means that they're going to talk to you that same way. And then also, there's so many red flags, drinking too much. And then his emotions would change. So I know that sometimes is an issue for a lot of our clients, where, you know, it's a Jekyll and Hyde. One aspect, they're this amazing human being, and then behind closed doors, maybe after they've had a couple of drinks or they've done, you know, drugs or something, they completely change and then beat the heck out of you. And, you know, there are a lot of red flags. You know, talk to their friends, talk to their family, do research online. Before you go out on a date with somebody, don't meet them in a private place. Meet them in a public place. Do research. We have this phone has more computing power than the very first computer we ever had. So use it, utilize it, look up Google, look up that person, and see if there's anything that pops up on the internet, because there could be. I remember walking through a crosswalk with my friend at the time, and I remember talking to her about my relationship with Paul, and I could hear God say, no, like, stay away. And it was more like this feeling, this warning feeling that I got, and I literally blatantly ignored it. I thought that it was my fear of getting involved in a relationship again, and worried that he wouldn't like me or something along those lines. But it was literally a warning sign to get out. And I know, you know, Paul was very possessive. He wouldn't let me pay for anything or carry cash. I literally, different points in the relationship, learned that I had to hide a credit card or hide my ID someplace, like in my boots or something. So if I had to escape or run away, which I did multiple times, that I could go to a hotel and stay in the hotel for the night. But yeah, there are many, many warning signs, and I write about a lot of them in But I Love Him.
It's an apt name for a book, isn't it? It draws you to it straight away. And it's something that has to be spoken about. It has to come out. This is a topic that no one should fear discussing. And I suppose in my career, and honestly, it would be daily, I would have somebody, whether it was a parent, you know, sobbing to me about the situation they were in and how they couldn't help their child because of A, B, C, and D, and how they sat there and had to watch the partner bash their kids. Right. And you know, it just blew me away. And it always came back to the same thing, that shame. the shame that they weren't good enough, because that's what they're being told, and the shame that they couldn't speak out to someone, but also didn't know where to go. Yeah. And can you give them some tips now? Where can you go? What are some of the things?
Yeah. You don't know what you don't know. So if you're stuck in an abusive relationship, sometimes if you start to look up domestic violence, that person is standing right over you. So if you go to unsilencedvoices.org, there's an escape button there. So if you go on and look at the resources, we provide a ton of resources, especially in America. Every single state, we have a shelter listed or a domestic violence center listed that can help you. We also have some worldwide organizations as well listed on our website. But, you know, the biggest thing is you just have to take that step. You have to get out. We're working with a client right now who's absolutely amazing, but she just got her permanent restraining order against her abuser. And she was interviewed on 60 Minutes, which is absolutely phenomenal. And she's speaking up, which is so great. But in the beginning stages, she had no place to go. She literally had to look up a shelter and go to a shelter and stay there for months before she finally got back on her feet. But staying in a shelter for months is so much better than staying in an abusive relationship for years where you could potentially die because you were being beaten down, not just physically, but emotionally as well. And oftentimes the emotional abuse has longer lasting implications than that of physical violence. So it is this this tug of war in a sense, and there needs to be more places for victims to go, but definitely talk to the police, definitely, you know, file a restraining order. That's the biggest thing to do because that protects you if something does happen. But yeah, look up resources all over. And I don't know some of the resources in Australia. I know a lot of them in LA and around the US.
And the police is the first place I used to tell our kids to go if it happened, you know, when they weren't at school. And it'd be the first place I would go. I'd be on the phone and had a phenomenal relationship with the local police, who'd be up at the school like a hat as fast as, you know, anything. And It's too often people think that the police don't want to know about it, or you know, it's too, you know, it's too mundane. Whereas police do, and they're trained to help people, and they have all the networks and the contacts. I know there's been many times where I've stayed behind at school to 9 o'clock with a child until somebody came and got them. And over here we have what's called docs. And if no one came, I would ring up the police station and I'd say, I'm not leaving until somebody comes here and takes this child and looks after it. And they would, and they would do it. And you're teaching the kids then too that there is an out, there's somewhere to go for help. And this is really important. We were very fortunate because the police would then would come onto the school grounds every lunch hour and walk in full uniform around the kids until the kids understood that there was no fear with the police, that they could talk to them, they were humans, they had great personalities, and that helped a lot as well. And whereas some people didn't like it, because obviously they didn't like it, because they felt like it was a police state or control, but it was a level that had to happen. And so going to those places and finding out the beauty, as you said, on the phone, you know, we have that piece of equipment, that tool, that people can find help straight away. But too often, if they're isolated, they have all that taken away from them. They don't have money, they're in total isolation, they can't have a phone, and they're literally put into a place where they can't go anywhere, and so they don't want to go anywhere because the unsafe is actually how they feel safe.
Yeah, but it's also, you know, changing your mentality. You know, if you're a victim, you've got to be able to, so we teach a 5-step process. So I do speaking all around the world. And yeah. I know we don't have very much time left, but I'd love to just briefly talk about those 5 steps.
Yeah,
and it's 5 steps to help you overcome obstacles and trauma. So we teach, the first step is recognize. You have to be able to recognize what you're going through, accept it, understand it, recognize what you're facing. It's the first step in any 12-step process is recognition. Recognize that you've got a problem, or recognize that this is happening. The next step is thoughts, being able to elevate your thoughts, being able to put in positive material so you can start thinking differently about the situation. Instead of waking up every day and saying, well, I hope I don't upset him, or I'm gonna be so upset. Something bad's gonna happen to me. You wake up thinking, okay, I can make it through this day and I can overcome this. And you start thinking positive to yourself. And then once you start thinking, then it has to go from your head to your heart. So the third step is feelings, being able to express yourself, which is so incredibly important. This is why we talk about speaking up, because with your feelings, you have to feel in order to heal, meaning that you actually have to go through the pain in order to actually come out on the other end healthy. So if you experienced trauma, or if you are involved in abuse right now, and then you leave, you have to feel through those emotions that you were hiding, right? Hindering. And there's something called adverse childhood experiences, that if something happens to you as a young adult or as a child, and you do not express yourself, whether it be through therapy or movement or dance or writing, if you hold it all in, then those emotions come out in physical and or emotional ailments as an adult, meaning autoimmune disorders, chronic fatigue and headaches, severe stress and anxiety. So definitely you have to feel through those emotions. And then once you get from recognized to thoughts, feelings, then we go to words, which is the fourth step. Put positive power words around you. You know, write on post-it notes, take pen to paper and just write, I am enough. Or on my bathroom mirror, I am beautiful. I can overcome. I can do this. Make sure to surround yourself with that positivity, because if you read that every day, it's like subliminal messaging. You know, even if you don't read it, subconsciously, your mind has already read it, you know, and those positive words need to come in your brain. And then the fifth step is action steps, you know, being able to take action, whether it is, you know, therapy, whether it is dance or movement. We also teach right now during COVID to go outside and get some fresh air, you know, take a walk around the block, make sure you get sleep, make sure you're eating well. We really teach writing therapy is something that helps so many people. So literally taking pen to paper, and it doesn't have to make sense. Stream of consciousness writing is okay. You don't have to share it with anybody, but just get it out. So I actually gift those five steps. I don't think that the text often works internationally, but you can always reach me at michellejewsbury.com. But if you're in the United States listening to this, all you need to do is text UNITE, UNITE, to 26786. Again, it's UNITE to 26786, and you'll get a PDF document of those five steps.
Great. Thank you so much. We've run out of time, Michelle. It's lovely having you here. If you would like to find Michelle on www.unsilencedvoices.org, you can pop across to her website. Feel free to come across to my website and leave a message if you want to contact Michelle. So that's tracytully.com, www.tracytully.com. Thank you for listening today, everyone. It's been wonderful having you, and really interesting a story there with Michelle Jewsbury, and something that is a story that we do have to hear, that we can't run away from. Next week, we have a lovely lady called Danielle Stearman from Victoria in Australia. And Danielle is a developer of children's products. So that's something we can look forward to next week. But thanks for listening to another 60 minutes of inspiring talking points with Tracy Tully Talks, brought to you today by bbsradio.com. Tune in every Thursday morning, Australian time at 10 a.m., PT time at 5 p.m. Thank you, everyone, and all the very best for today. And we will catch up with you, Michelle, down the track, no doubt.
Thank you so much, Tracy, and I appreciate being able to share my story with your audience.
Great. So if you want to find out any more, you want to know how you can contact Michelle for sponsorship, please let me know either on my Tracy Tully Talks, bbsradio.com/Tracy Tully Talks website, or across to my business website, tracytully.com. So please don't be afraid to speak out and ask for our support and help, or offer support and help in any way that you can. Thank you, Michelle. Have a lovely evening over there in America. And thank you to all our listeners. We look forward to hearing you again next Thursday, same time. Thank you, Michelle.
Thank you very, very much, Tracy.
Thanks for listening to another 60 minutes of inspiring talking points on Tracy Tully Talks, brought to you by bbsradio.com. Tune in every Thursday morning at 10 a.m. Australian time, AEST, and 5 p.m. PT time in America. Leave me a message on my website at www.bbsradio.com/Tracy Tully Talks. If you're interested in lifting the profile, presence, and profit of your business, sponsorship opportunities are available. Until next Thursday, it's goodbye from me.